Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas on Monday, August 11th, day number 213 of 2014. Today we're going to catch up with our good friend Frank Burke, and we're going to talk about American Graffiti. And if you haven't heard, American Graffiti is 41 years old today. It was released on this day in 1973, and it was actually a very interesting film, and we'll get into that with Frank. We're also going to look at some other films of that era, and Frank has some very interesting thoughts about how it all comes together. So American Graffiti today, as we look at the 41st anniversary of a movie that was not supposed to be consequential, but in fact became very consequential. Just a quick word about our friends at audible.com. If you're looking for an audiobook, all you have to do is go to the link, the show information, and see audible.com, your source for audiobooks. Click on that. It'll take you to their incredible inventory, their website, and you will see just about every audiobook you can imagine. Just click on there. It'll take you to the website, and if you want to get a book, hey, listen, we will appreciate that extremely. So get yourself an audiobook and make my day, okay? We're going to take a little break, and we've got Frank Burke, on the other side. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, where it's 100 degrees, well, not quite 100, like 96, and number two son and me, we're going to the baseball game tonight, so it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun going to a baseball game when it's this hot. Before we get to Frank and American Graffiti, I just wanted to do a quick plug for an article that I will have at the American Thinker tomorrow. As you know, I like to post over at the American Thinker, and I have an article tomorrow about the 2014 U.S. Senate elections, where I will predict to you right now that the Republicans will win the U.S. Senate in November. And the way they're going to do it is there are several elections at play, as you know, but they're going to pick up Montana, West Virginia, and South Dakota. Those three are pretty good. So you start with those three. You need six, and you start with those three. And then I think the other three are going to come by picking up either Alaska, Arkansas, Louisiana, and North Carolina. If they win all seven of those, of course, that will take care of it. There's also a very good chance in Iowa, where there's a wonderful lady running for the U.S. Senate who's doing a heck of a good job, and she's doing very well in some of the polling. Now, Colorado is the other one where I think that's more of a 50-50 situation, but Colorado is going through a very interesting political situation right now, and it could be picked up. But I still think it's kind of iffy because some of the demographics of Colorado. So I do think they will get their six seats by picking up Montana, West Virginia, South Dakota, Arkansas, Alaska, Louisiana, those, and North Carolina. That's where I believe the six will come from those seven, actually six of those seven, to pick up the majority. So check out my article at the American Thinker tomorrow. I'll get into a little bit more detail. Let me say hello to Frank Burke. How are you, Frank?
Well, thanks, Sylvia, and you?
Absolutely great. What did you think of my little prediction there?
I think you're right, and my fingers are crossed, and I'm saying prayers.
Yes. We're lighting some candles there.
If it's legitimate, I don't see how it doesn't go that way. But living here in Wisconsin, where they say there's no such thing as voter fraud, and having seen lots and lots of it, I just get very frightened that at some point they're going to turn it on like the way they got Al Franken in Minnesota.
Yeah, that's interesting, because Al Franken is another one, too, who may be iffy. But I don't have enough information to make a call on that one. But my friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor up in Minnesota, he thinks it could be a Republican pickup. I just don't have enough information. I'm going to stick to the ones that I have. But you're right. I mean, if the votes are honest, but you know how – remember what happened in Milwaukee in 2000 where they were handing out cigarettes? Remember that?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And not just 2000, but the last presidential election where the Racine ballots from a number of the districts there were clearly tampered with. The bags that were supposed to be sealed, they were sealed, they were cut open, and then they were put into other bags. So there's no doubt about it. This is it's a serious problem.
It is a problem.
The holder is fighting voter ID, you know.
Right.
Picture ID.
You're exactly right. Well, let's talk about something fun. American
yes.
Graffiti. American Graffiti, 41 years old today, was released on this day in 1973. And I thought I'd begin by just kind of setting the table a little bit for the listeners, because this is a movie. Some of the listeners may know that in the movie industry, you've got something called a low-budget film. And a low-budget film, Frank, as I'm sure you know, is a movie that is made, put together quickly with unknown players or stars. And the whole idea is to make a buck. You put this movie out, hopefully you get back whatever you put in, and you've got something to show in the movie theaters. And there are tons of these movies. They used to also be called B-movies back in the days of black and white. So anyway, they made this movie. A gentleman by the name of Mr. Lucas, I think his first name is George Lucas, made this movie. It's basically filmed in the city of Modesto, California, which was his hometown. As I said, it was a low-budget film. It cost $700,000 to make, $770,000 to make, Frank. Even back then, that was not a lot of money for a film. But here's the interesting part. It was financed by investors because Mr. Lucas couldn't get any studio to pick it up. But now, looking back at it, it is one of the most profitable films ever made. It grossed over $200 million. Now, Frank, you're really good with numbers, but if I invest $700,000 and I make $200 million, that's a pretty good investment. What kind of return is that, 3,000% or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's right up there.
Yeah, it's up there. So that has to be about the only thing better than this is cocaine, and that's not legal. So anyway, so that is quite an investment. One more thing about the movie, it introduced big time a couple of names. Ron Howard, of course, everybody knew Ron. He was the kid in the Andy Griffith Show, but this was I think his big role as a young man, because everybody knew him as a kid. And then a couple of other names that became very popular later: Harrison Ford and Richard Dreyfuss, a couple of names that became very popular in future movies. I think Harrison Ford in Star Wars. I don't remember Richard Dreyfuss, but certainly Harrison Ford in Star Wars and Dreyfuss and other movies. One more quick thing. Which one was he in, Richard Dreyfuss? I don't remember.
Jaws.
Which one?
Jaws.
Okay, and that came...
After that, he went on to Jaws, yeah.
To Jaws, and I think he also made a movie about... He was a music teacher, wasn't he?
Yes.
Orpheus movie or something? I don't remember the title, but anyway, he made a movie
Michelle
about...
Michelle Phillips was in it.
Michelle Phillips from that television show about the single mom with a couple of kids, wasn't that also...
Mm-hmm.
And then the young woman who was... Ron Howard's girlfriend, I think she was from Laverne and Shirley, as I recall, right, another show. But the biggest show that came out of this, was, of course, Happy Days, with Fonzie and all of that. And Happy Days was huge in the 70s here in the United States. I'm not sure how it played overseas, but it was huge here. And then, of course, another thing that came out of this movie, Frank, was the movie Grease, which is also a Broadway show. And there was a huge revival of 1950s music, of this kind of music, in the mid-70s to late-70s. And I'll say one more thing, Frank, then I promise to let you talk.
One thing,
I'm doing okay. Well, thank you so much for that support. Another thing I'll say about this movie, I wrote a review of this movie a couple years ago, back in 2011. And I said that the script itself, if you just read the script, it was just a pretty simple script, just another script about teenagers. I mean, nothing really substantial. Very much like Saturday Night Fever, by the way, not very substantial. But what made this movie, just like Saturday Night Fever, what made this movie was the music. Now, a little difference with Saturday Night Fever, that was original music from the Bee Gees, whereas in American Graffiti, because it was such a low-budget film, kind of interesting, they couldn't afford to write original music, so they just went back and brought back some of the music from that time. So anyway, success story, to say the least, American Graffiti, Frank. Frank, I'll be quiet now for a couple of minutes, and I'll let you talk. How's that?
Well, as I say, Silvio, I enjoy listening to you. So.
Well, thank you, Frank.
A couple of words about it, and that's, of course, the thing about any film, especially one like this, is seeing it in context. And let's go back for a moment into the 50s and look at the movies that dealt with young people and young people's problems. Is that you have the emergence of juvenile delinquency, as seen in films like High School Confidential and Blackboard Jungle, which I believe one of my favorite quotes from the old New York Daily News. They were praising, I think it was High School Confidential, and they said it was a good look at the street toughs and electric chair candidates. So you had that kind of film. And then you had films like, you know, a Marlon Brando in The Wild One,
mm-hmm.
and the James Dean films, Rebel Without a Cause, and before that, East of Eden, that showed the alienated teenager. So you had a lot of this stuff about young people who are not doing very well. And then suddenly this movie comes on, and it's a really interesting movie because it's both a happy movie, a movie with a lot of laughs and a lot of funny sequences, kids being kids, thinking about things. But overlaying it all, you have the tragedy that is Vietnam. And, of course, that is mentioned in the movie. The one lead character, I think you know that better than I do, who in the end gives the keys to his car to the nerdy kid because he's going into the service.
Right. I think is the character, Frank, if I may interrupt you for a second. This is the character. I don't remember his name right now, but he was older than most of the kids. He had graduated from – most of these kids were graduating from high school in 1962, which is what the movie's about. They're the night they graduated or a couple of days after they graduated. The young man that you're talking about had graduated in 1959. So he was 3 years older, and he was kind of like the leader of the pack, if you know what I mean. And you're right. He's the one that goes off to Vietnam, and in the end of the movie, when they're telling you the story of each kid, he gets killed in Vietnam, of course, as another 56,000 young men did in that war. So anyway, just wanted to fill that in.
And, you know, it's an interesting thing because when they did that, where in the end it was very, if you will, a stab at cinema verite, although they were all actors, where they defined what happened to the characters. The other movie that did that, and it came along later, it was 1978, was The Deer Hunter. And The Deer Hunter, for anyone who lived through that time in Vietnam, it's an absolutely devastating film. It's a very hard film to watch. I saw it when it came out. I've only seen it once since then because it just brings back so much. And, you know, is it about Vietnam? Yeah, but more than that, it's about friendship. And I think that's what also hit with American Graffiti. It was like even in these were kids that we knew. They weren't super kids. They weren't bad kids. They weren't psycho cases or over alienated. They were just regular kids doing the things that we would like to have done as kids. Coming from New York, there's no way I could have a car at that age or go cruising or anything else. And again, as you and I had mentioned, it's very much a California film.
Yes, Modesto, California, which I don't remember right now where that is. I don't know if that's. I think it's in Southern California. Is it in Modesto?
Yes.
Over. I don't know how far it is from L.A. either, but it's an interesting film because these kids. If you think about the movie, it's basically a 24 or 48 hour period right after they graduate from high school. They have the graduation dance, the graduation. And I think all of us relate to that. You know, when you graduate, you have your ceremony, and then everybody goes to a party or whatever, Frank. But these were basically kids just having a good time. I mean, there's nothing deadly about what they did. I mean, they didn't kill anybody, as I recall.
Right,
they were
right.
Just a bunch of, you know, just a bunch of kids having a good time. And very much, I thought the movie was very much the way 1962 was, which is where you had a lot of... you know, you didn't have a lot of sex between teenagers. I guess that's what I'm trying to say, with all due respect to anybody listening. It was basically one of those, you know, you can see but you can't touch type of of attitudes between young men and young women. But of course, there's some great scenes, you know, in the back seat and all of that, which of course was very, you know, a lot of the songs back then were about, you know, making out in the back seat of your car, that kind of thing.
Right.
But of course, you only went so far, you know, as everybody knows. But anyway, it was just an interesting movie. It was just fun, but nobody thought it would be consequential. It became very consequential because I think it filled. There was also something else happening at that time, Frank. You may remember too, and that's Watergate. It was kind of a depressing time. The country was kind of depressed, and I think it probably needed something like this.
I think very much so. And, you know, it's an interesting thing. And if you look at this chronologically, I'm glad to be able to mention this to you because I'd like to get your reaction. And it's something I've always wondered about, okay? You go back and think about in our generation, there are any number of radio stations. In fact, go to any major market, and there's a radio station that plays the golden oldies. And the golden oldies, some of them go back to the 50s. They'll be playing Elvis, who came up in 1956. And, you know, so you're looking at now, what, 60 years ago. You're looking at something that is almost 60 years ago. Okay, but now think about it this way. If you went back, now they didn't have golden oldies stations when you went back to the 1950s or 60s, because if they had a golden oldies station like that in the 60s, they'd be playing the top hits of 1900.
Right, exactly, yeah, I know.
And that goes way, way back.
They'd be playing Rudy Valentino, right, where they would be playing.
Right. But, you know, it's the kind of thing where I think we as a generation, especially the baby boomer generation, have wanted very much to hold on to those things. Music is obviously very emotional. When you hear it, it can take you back to where you were when you knew that song early on and the high school dances and whatever. And as a generation, I think our generation has wanted to relive that or at least to keep it alive more than other generations. Well, you know, didn't want to relive the World War II or the Great Depression, maybe, or World War I. But that was something else. And I think American Graffiti was largely a celebration of that.
Yeah. Well, I think so. The music, I mean, that time period, 1973-74, musically speaking, was not one of the best. And if you study the history of pop music, and I love doing that, you have different periods, and we've talked about this other time, Frank. Obviously, you had in the 50s, you had the Elvis music, you know, the Black Sound, Chuck Berry, and then you had doo-wop, which is one of my favorites. Then you had the girl groups. But then, you know, basically during that time, 60s, 62-63. The music was really not that good. I mean, I'm sorry, 73-74 later. The music was not that good. And I think a lot of teenagers, like they always like to do, a lot of young people like to go dancing and relate to this song or that song. And there really wasn't anything going on in 73 or 74 that was frankly that remarkable if you go back to that time. And yet here comes this soundtrack from American Graffiti, Frank, and it just wakes you up, you know, songs like See You in September, Rock Around the Clock. Now, a lot of those songs were not actually from the summer of 62. That's where some of the fantasy comes in. But nevertheless, they were absolutely great songs to dance to. And I think a lot of, I don't know, everybody just got caught up in American Graffiti. I mean, some of these songs, you may remember some of these songs, Frank, you know, See You in September.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, See You in September is one of the greatest songs, I think, of all time. You know, you got Rock Around the Clock, Step by Step. Here's one from the movie that I really like by Lou Christie called The Gypsy Cried. I mean, what a great song that is. So I think maybe the kids in 73, 74 saw an opportunity to dance to music. And, you know, I love John Denver, but he's tough to dance to, if you know what
I
mean.
Right.
I mean, John Denver's great, but I don't think he's somebody you dance to. But you do dance to Rock Around the Clock, Frank.
Well, you do. And, you know, look at what was happening at that time. Let's put it in what you might call a macro context. We didn't know what we know about him now. But the Kennedy presidency came in. There was this tremendous emphasis on youth and public service and 50-mile hikes and all this positivity. The biggest lie, and I go back to a line, I'm not crazy about the singer, but Paul Simon's line, when I think back on all the crap I learned in high school,
right.
It's a wonder I didn't think at all,
something like
that.
Yeah, that's a song called Kodachrome.
That he
recorded. That I think that was his first solo hit after breaking up with Art Garfunkel. And he recorded that song called Kodachrome. And you're right, that's one of the great classic lines of, because everybody relates to that line.
Well, yeah, because we were told we could be anything we wanted to, and that was a blatant lie.
Right.
But we believed it at the time, and it was a very, very positive time, except for Vietnam. Then, of course, the next year after that, 63, Kennedy gets shot, and you have Vietnam goes into high gear, and there becomes the drug culture becomes much bigger. But the 70s, to me, were a time of decadence in a lot of ways.
Yes.
Not just the drugs, but think about it. And I've always loved architecture, and architecture mirrors fashion. The 70s was the worst period fashion-wise, in the 20th century. It was the absolute pits, the bottom, the bell bottoms, and the you know, all the psychedelic garbage and whatever, and the beehive hairstyles and the dark eye makeup that the girls wore. It was disgusting. It just nothing was pretty about it. Nothing was...
Well, another thing, too, about the 70s, Frank, if I could just say this very quickly, another thing about the 70s is that I think that this decadence that you're talking about was also the way women were treated. Because if you go back to the songs, you know, of the 50s and to some extent the 60s and the 40s, you know, women were treated in a very romantic way. But if you look at the music of the 70s, that's when I think a lot of the stuff that ended up in this deplorable and just absolutely sick and pathetic hip-hop that we have now, where women are treated so poorly. I mean, they talk about women in such disrespectful ways, but you go back to some of the songs of the, you know, even the 60s, I mean, some of the songs that the Beatles wrote or whatever, there was a lot more beauty and a lot more romance in the way we talked about women. And in the 70s, that just all went to heck. I mean, it unfortunately continues today. But to me, yeah, I agree with you. The 70s were, I mean, look, I spent 10 years of my life in the 70s, but I wish I had spent, instead of having spent 10 years of my life in the 70s, I wish I had been born so that I could spend 10 years of my life in the 40s, because I think I would have loved the 40s a lot more than music. Just everything about the 40s and the 30s were so much better. But, of course, you don't choose when you live. You live whenever you're born. But sometimes wasn't the 1920s a little bit like the 70s? I mean, we have this notion of the 1920s as being so, you know, romantic and so much fun. But yet the 20s were kind of a sick decade in a way too, weren't they, Frank?
They were. They were very much so, because it was getting over World War One, and it was a lost generation. I think that's what Fitzgerald called it, and he lived it. And believe me, nobody got more lost than Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald.
That's right.
A mad woman and an alcoholic. That's
right.
Kind of a combination.
That's right. And for some of the listeners who may not know, you're such a gifted, you're so gifted on literature, but for some of the listeners who may not know, who was Scott Fitzgerald and what did he write?
He wrote The Great Gatsby.
Yes, there you go. Was that his greatest work?
I think it's his most popular work, mm-hmm. and probably, if you had to put it that way, yes. The book that is really fascinating, though, that came later, that was like the end of it, when it all crashed down, is Tender as the Night. And that is a very weirdly written book, because it seems like in the middle of it, the lead characters, which are two couples, one couple starts acting like the other and vice versa. But not to get into English class here, but Fitzgerald was the icon of the 20s. He was extremely handsome. His wife was very pretty. They were the beautiful people of the decade. And by the time the decade was over, it was just too much. They were mired in alcoholism, and she had nervous breakdowns. And ultimately, he would drink himself to death, and she would be in a mental institution.
Now, what was her name? What was his wife's name? I don't remember his wife's name.
Zelda.
Okay.
Her maiden name was Zelda Sayer. She was from the South, I believe from Alabama. And then she married him, and she actually, some of the things she wrote to him, which he put into his books, were absolutely beautiful writing. So,
do you remember any of it? Do you remember any of it, Frank, that you could share with us?
I don't offhand.
Was it like letters that she wrote to him? Is that what you're saying?
There was a piece that she wrote in that he used in his first novel. His first successful novel was called This Side of Paradise.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about the graves of the Confederate dead. It was just, it's very moving. It's very ethereal and very moving.
Right.
But hang on a minute.
Anyway, let me just do a quick announcement, Frank, while you're looking that up. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas. We're going to go a little bit longer with Frank today because he's so interesting, as he always is. My goodness, Frank, how do you know so much? I envy you. I mean, how do you know so much? I mean, you must be a walking encyclopedia. I absolutely love Frank. He's just an absolutely great guy. But we're talking about American Graffiti. And we've gotten into The Great Gatsby, or Scott Fitzgerald, who is also a great writer. And I have a question for you about Great Gatsby in a second, Frank, but I just wanted to remind the listeners that audible.com is your source for audiobooks. And if you would like to read The Great Gatsby in an audiobook, why don't you go to audible.com? There's a link in the show information and get yourself a copy of that book. And by the way, speaking of audiobooks, many people have actually sent me notes. In fact, I had a gentleman the other day send me an email saying he was going to buy a copy of my book, but he wanted to know if the book is going to be available in Spanish. And I said, because he wanted to buy the book for his mom, I said, no, it's not available for Spanish now. We're working on that. And then he said, is it going to be available in audiobooks? And I said, well, no, we're working on that as well. One of my sons wants to do the audio version. Frank, this is my son. This is my son who's going to law school and who just told me yesterday that he's going to be recording a CD before he goes back to law school. And I'm saying, oh, my God, what is the CD about? Well, he said, I'll tell you tonight at the ball game. So I'll find out what kind of music he's in. I'm sure he's not doing I left my heart in San Francisco. I don't think he's I don't think he's doing that. But I'll find out more about him. I'll find out more about him tonight. Anyway, what were you able to find out about Mrs. Scott Fitzgerald?
I have not been able to find the quote.
But you're saying that he did write to her, or she wrote to him, and he included. But my question about Great Gatsby is this one, Frank, and how well has that book been represented in movies? There have been several movies about the book. The one that I like the most is the one with Robert Redford.
I'm with you. And for the music in it.
Yeah, well, the music was fantastic also. But how well represented has it been in the movies? I mean, I remember reading the book in high school. It was almost required reading. But I always felt that, you know, the movie, the Robert Redford movie was more of a romantic movie, I thought. But hey, I don't know what Gatsby was a romantic novel, in your opinion, was it?
I think it was, but, you know, it's funny because we had my son, of course, is an English major, and he and some friends were talking about Gatsby for a bit. They all read it together, and I had the chance to talk with them about it. And here's what I think, and this is my personal opinion. I think that Gatsby was almost impossible to translate into a successful movie, and they keep trying, but it never really works for one reason, and that's the fact that you have to understand the way in which Gatsby loved Daisy, and that's at the whole crux of the movie and the story. And the bottom line is that Fitzgerald grew up in a very Catholic, Irish Catholic household. And even though he later was not particularly a church-going guy, he never lost that. The seed story about that became the Great Gatsby started out as something about an altar boy. But the bottom line was, if you go through that, what Gatsby wants and can never have is the fact that he wants Daisy to have loved him and to have loved him exclusively. She cannot have loved her husband, Tom. She has to have loved him with this very pure love because she was his real first love. And that's a very important part of that. And it's the one thing that, in essence, Gatsby is very deep and spiritual. And that's what he's looking for the little green light on her dock. But she is very shallow. She cannot understand that. But what makes Gatsby so hard to understand for modern audiences is the fact that Gatsby doesn't just want to grab Daisy and have sex with Daisy or even just marry Daisy. He wants a total and a pure love between himself and Daisy. And regardless of what happened after the fact, after they, you know, they met when he was a young soldier in World War I, regardless of the fact that she married someone else and even had a child, he wants to be assured of her continued and exclusive love.
Right.
I hope I didn't take too much
time. No, but I think what you just said right now is what makes it so difficult for a current or modern audience, as you call it, because the modern audience is accustomed to, you know, not accustomed to, I mean, I'm saying what they see in movies now is love, which is purely physical. And they don't really see the kind of love that Gatsby and Daisy had. And what Gatsby was madly in love with Daisy, but he never, you know, he never really, I mean, eventually, obviously, they would have had a physical relationship. But what I'm saying is that wasn't what he was looking for. What he was looking for was just this absolute, almost perfect love that he had with this woman, Daisy, who I believe in the book, Frank, as I recall, she says, "I cannot marry you because rich girls don't marry poor boys." I think something
That's
like
right,
that
exactly.
She said. And then, of course, I don't know how much motivation that was for him to get wealthy, or whether he just got wealthy as a coincidence. I don't know, but clearly, he thought of her differently. And so you're right. So when they try to do these movies, I have not seen the new. There's a new Gatsby movie now with, I think, Brad Pitt or whatever. I have not seen that. But
oh, the one with DiCaprio.
Oh, DiCaprio. I have not seen it, so I don't have any review of it. But the one with Redford, I thought, came pretty close to that pure love between them, because they were very much, I mean, they had these encounters where they would talk for hours. I mean, they would
yes.
just sit there and talk for hours, and, you know, they would literally sit there next to each other and just talk for hours. And
mm-hmm.
there was no, and I think that's maybe a little bit difficult for some of the modern audiences to understand, because they're sitting there saying, when are they going to have some sex? You know, when
exactly.
you know, I mean, well, that's not what happened between them. I mean, eventually, I'm sure it probably did, but it never really came out in the book that way. And anyway, that's why I think you're so correct in saying that Gatsby is so difficult to understand. Now, do you think that, just one more question about Gatsby here before we get back to American Graffiti, do you think that Gatsby was a criticism of capitalism, or do you think that he was praising capitalism in that movie, or does it really matter?
Well, I think, let's put it this way, I don't know that it was specifically capitalism that he was talking about, but I think it was what he was talking about was the high life of the 20s, coming back to your earlier comment about the 20s being kind of a sick period, that the 20s, for the wealthy classes, the 20s were a period, no doubt, of tremendous excess. And you go to any major city and, you know, look at the old streets where the big mansions are that were built by the people who made a lot of money in the 20s before the Depression. And they lived large, they lived high, and it could not go on forever. The movies more or less demonstrated that. You look at the, what was it, Flaming Youth was one of the titles.
Right.
And it was about young people drinking and getting drunk and driving big cars and just, you know, wasting their lives, in effect.
Right, yeah. It's a decade that, I think we look back at it now, and it's the music that charms us, and there were some great songs. The Charleston, I think, was the big dance of that time. But clearly,
yeah.
the life of most people was not, unless you were very, very wealthy, life was not a lot of fun. And if you were very, very wealthy, you were probably wasting your life with liquor and decadence. So it was not probably, it was a tough decade for immigrants who were coming here, who had to struggle a great deal. I mean, this was a time, I suppose, when we were still, when you still had factories working very long hours. It was not an easy time to live, I guess. That's what I'm trying to say. And then, of course, you had the Great Depression that came after that and sort of leveled a lot of... But let me go back to America. Just want to go back to American Graffiti for a second, because you were talking
sure.
about James Dean. And, of course, for people who are fans of the Beatles, a lot of people do not, you know, they'll say, well, where did the word Beatles come? Of course, Beatles, B-E-A-T-L-E-S. Actually comes from a movie of James Dean. That word Beatles actually comes from that movie. I didn't know that. Did you know that, Frank?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that the word Beatles was actually mentioned in a James Dean film. And, of course, you know, the Beatles being, or John and Paul being part of that generation, would be watching James Dean movies. I mean, they would have been 17, 18, 19 when James Dean was in the prime of his life before he was killed. He was killed, right, in a car accident. I don't remember.
He was. Actually, it was September 30th, 1955.
Hmm.
He was driving a souped-up Porsche with a friend of his, and it wasn't his fault, oddly enough. A guy by the odd name of Donald Turnipseed turned in front of him, and his Porsche crashed into him. But, you know, it was one of those things where he was at the peak of his popularity when he died, and a lot of people, a lot of young kids, refused to believe he was dead. The studio would get, you know, lots of mail addressed to him even long after he had passed away.
So that would have been, what, you said 1955, so right before Elvis then, right?
Right,
so
yeah, exactly.
So he was kind of like, he was not a singer like Elvis, obviously, but he was pretty big, wasn't he?
He was very big, yeah, because the first movie he made was an adaptation of John Steinbeck's East of Eden, which is about two brothers, and he played the younger brother, Cal, who is dying for his father's love, but the father just doesn't see him. The father is so wrapped up in the older brother. And Julie Harris does a superb job as the girl who is initially the older boy's girlfriend, but she comes to love the younger guy. And it's a heartbreaking movie. It really is. But it shows how this teenager who's trying to make his way in the world, how he's rejected and alienated. And that's what kids identified with. So when that happened, when that got very popular, they then did Rebel Without a Cause, which right. is really a kind of potboiler. It had Natalie Wood and Sal Mineo, and it was about, you know, the new kid in town going to the high school and not being understood and being rejected by everybody. And, it was just, let's put it this way, it wasn't cinema's finest moment, but the kids loved it.
Right, and what's interesting about that movie, what year was that released? It must have been 53, 54, I take it, right?
I believe it was.
Because he was killed in 55, so it couldn't have been too much earlier than that.
That's right.
Yeah. But I'm thinking you don't, you know, the reason I've always found that movie so interesting is because you don't associate juveniles. I mean, the 50s were supposed to be this perfect, you know, this perfect time of, you know, Harriet, what was the name of that show? Ozzie and Harriet and Father Knows Best.
Yes.
Somehow, you know, James Dean doesn't fit into any of those shows. You know, he almost seems more like a kid out of the 60s, but kind of maybe premature. I don't know.
Very much so, very much so. And he was a very strange person himself. James Dean, you know, let's put it this way. He had a lot of, I think, what you would call today psychological problems. He was so into acting that when he was on Broadway, and he was on Broadway in a couple of plays, artsy kind of stuff, André Gide's play, The Immoralist, and every night he would come in and do the role differently. And it was driving the other actors crazy because they couldn't predict where he was going to be, you know, what they call blocking, moving around the stage. Nobody knew where the heck this guy was going to show up or how he was going to play a scene. And it got to the point where literally one of the other actors punched him out.
Wow.
And said, "You've got to stop this." And he said, no, I need the truth of my performance. So it was a little over the top.
Yeah. Well, getting back to American Graffiti for a second, Frank, I think two big lessons out of American Graffiti, and that is from a business standpoint, if you believe in something, stick with it. Because, I mean, Lucas had this film, and he was turned down by everybody, and yet he said, no, this is a good movie, and I'm going to release it. And he went out and got some private investors. That's not always easy to do, but he did it. And I don't think any of those investors are complaining about the return on their investment, Frank. That may have been the best investment they ever made. So I guess the lesson is, if you believe in something, keep doing it. Don't quit. Keep at it. And eventually, somebody will open a door for you. And so that's kind of what I think of the movie. And the other is that, any movie about kids with good music will always sell. So,
yes.
So if you have go ahead, yeah.
I was going to say, and there has to be an element of truth to it. If it isn't the way kids are, it's the way kids wish they were. And that's very important.
That's a good point. You have to watch this thing and believe that you're watching something real. If you don't associate with any other characters, and that was that's the beauty of American Graffiti, that there's a character in that movie for everybody. Even the kid who is a bit of a nerd, everybody associates with him. Obviously the beautiful blonde. What 16-year-old boy doesn't have a fantasy about watching some blonde in a car? I mean, every kid that fantasy, you're driving and next to you there's a beautiful car with a blonde in it. Well, I think every kid had that fantasy at some point in their lives, Frank.
Well, and it was Suzanne Somers that played the blonde in the car.
Right, that's right. I forgot about that. And she, of course, went on to have quite a successful career. And I'm trying to think of what show she was in.
Three's Company, I think, was
the okay, movie. The one where she was, yeah, I know, where she would, that's right, she had this other, I know, that one, and then I was thinking of Charlie's Angels, but that's somebody else. Yeah,
right.
that's another blonde. So I think everybody, and every kid, I think, relates to that movie, American Graffiti. There's a character in that show that everybody relates to, and that's why I think you say it has to be truthful. I think American Graffiti is truthful. I mean, that was, well, every kid relates to that, Frank.
Yes, exactly. And even today, I think, you know, that's why some of those songs, in effect, really keep coming back and keep being remade. And you know, it was interesting because if you look at some of the songs that we knew that came out of the 50s and 60s, and we thought that they were our songs, and I'll take several, Blue Velvet, Twilight Time, and a couple of others. These things were done by the Dorseys and the other bands in the 30s and 40s.
Right. Interesting. And some of the, by the way, some of the songs like Twilight Time and Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, was a very famous Spanish group that my parents used to love out of Argentina. They were called Los Cinco Latinos, literally means the Five Latins. And they were very much, they would do the Spanish versions of many of the Platters tunes, and they're absolutely beautiful. I'm going to send you an email with some of their songs, and obviously in Spanish, but they did such a unique arrangement of some of those songs. But I think, you know, I have a funny feeling that when they do, you know, when they rank the movies, they're not going to rank American movie. I mean, they're not going to rank American Graffiti with Gone with the Wind or something like that. But it'll get pretty good ratings, Frank. I have a feeling that 100 years from now, somebody will talk about it. It's one of those movies that will be consequential.
Yes. Yes, I think you're right. It's so much of a period piece. And, you know, it will live.
Yeah.
It'll go on.
I think so. It's that kind of a movie. Well, let's go from the fun to the depressing for a few minutes here, Frank. We don't have a lot of time, but I do have an article. I had an article today at American Thinker about Iraq in which I'm basically calling on President Obama to make up his mind and tell us what he really wants to do in Iraq, because he sounds very confused to me. On one hand, he says, I got to do something. On the other hand, it's almost like he's afraid to do something. Well, I wish he would make up his mind and tell us what is going on there, because, you know, Frank, we're facing an enemy, a pretty evil enemy in Iraq. I mean, I don't know if you heard about this, but there was a picture that was going around where they took this eight-year-old girl, and they cut her head off. Now, you tell me, if that's not evil, what is evil? They've got 40,000 people up in a mountain that they're starving. If that's not evil, what is evil? So if we're going to fight for something, Frank, if the United States is ever going to fight for something, and I speak as the father of a young man in the military who could be involved in some of these missions, but if we're not going to fight for something, I mean, if we're not going to fight for that, what are we going to fight for? So
And we've got to fight to win. It's not a matter of, well, let's push them back. It's a matter of, let's exterminate them. Let's get rid of them.
They're no good.
They're not going to be good. And if you leave them, they're going to grow again.
Well, that's it. And I think that's my criticism of President Obama. We should have done something about this 6 months ago. But he's got a real problem with his base on this. And he's got a problem because he basically got elected and then reelected. I mean, he ran for reelection in 2012 saying he had ended the war. And that comes as a big surprise today, because that war never ended. I mean, just because you pull the troops out, it doesn't mean the war is over. And he's learning, I think, the hard way that it didn't end. But I think he needs to make up his mind. I would like to see him, frankly, escalate the attacks and really go after these people and devastate them, like you're saying. Just literally take out the B-52s and just, you know, run them for a while.
Yeah. You take the dust off the napalm.
That's well, that wouldn't be a bad idea either. But there's certainly the B-52s, you know, put them up in the air a few days a week and let them drop a few bombs, because there's nothing good about people who cut little girls' heads off. I'm sorry.
No,
I don't know. I don't see anything good about people who will do that. I mean, somebody was telling me about this picture, and I don't even want to look at the picture. Because it would make me even more upset if I look at the picture of an 8-year-old girl and they cut her hair off because she's a girl. Come on.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely incredible. Absolutely. Well, Frank, thank you so much.
Silvio,
go ahead.
Just a second.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
To end this note on at least a more poetic note, I did find the quote.
Oh, good, good. Well, read it to us, please.
This was from her diary, which he appropriated into the book, This Side of Paradise, where the hero is going toward. He's at twilight in a graveyard. At twilight, he came to a graveyard. There was a dusky, dreamy smell of flowers and the ghost of a new moon in the sky and shadows everywhere. On an impulse, he considered trying to open the door of a rusty iron vault built into the side of a hill, a vault washed clean and covered with late-blooming, weepy, watery blue flowers that might have grown from dead eyes, sticky to the touch with a sickening odor. Amory wanted to feel William Dayfield, 1864. He wondered if graves ever made people consider life in vain. Somehow he could find nothing hopeless in having lived. All the broken columns and clasped hands and doves and angels meant romances. He fancied that in 100 years, he would like having young people speculate as to whether his eyes were brown or blue, and he hoped quite passionately that his grave would have about it an air of many, many years ago. It seemed strange that out of a row of Union soldiers, 2 or 3 made him think of dead loves and dead lovers when they're exactly like the rest, even to the yellowish moss.
Wow. And then, of course, just to put it in some historical perspective, when she wrote that, what would have been, the 1910s maybe?
Probably.
The Civil War was only 50 years old. So they were still veterans of the Civil War who were around.
Mm-hmm.
And, there was a still sense of loss, and there were still brothers who had lost their brothers in the war. So there was still an emotional, every generation has an emotional attachment, I think, to the dead of a particular war, obviously. Our generation, Frank, has it to Vietnam and to, obviously, the more recent wars. Our parents' generation have it to World War II. Back in the 1910s and in the early part of the century, the emotional attachment was to the Civil War because it was so devastating and it hurt so many people. So I think there's a little bit of that in her writing, too, I think.
Yes, very much so, especially growing up in the South.
Oh, there is another thing, too, yeah.
Being that much aware of it, yeah.
Yeah, because the other thing, too, about the South and a lot of people, I mean, the both sides took severe losses, but in the South, the losses were even more severe. I mean, the fact mm-hmm. is that just about every Southern family lost a husband, a son, a brother. I mean, I think the losses in the South were just devastating. They were still bad in the North, but in the South, because it was a smaller population, they were even more devastating. So if you were born in the South, you had a family member who was killed in the war. It was almost automatic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why, you know, it's still, among some people down there, it's still a real thing. There's still a feeling for this.
Well, you don't have to go very far.
I
have a very good friend here in Texas who grew up in East Texas, and he's about maybe 75 years old, and he says, we talked about this one day, and he says, look, you know, the feelings are still very strong. Not as much as they used to be, of course, but they're still fairly strong because the graveyards are right there. You see the cemeteries. I mean, you drive around and you see a cemetery and you see a name that is part of your family, who a young man who was killed when he was 18. Or something like that, and he was somebody, part of your family. So there was a great relation. Well, Frank, have a great day, my friend. Absolutely
hey.
Great as always. I mean, I just
thanks
man.
So much, Sylvia.
What movie do you want to review next?
Let me think about that one, but I'm sure we can come up with a few that'll be great.
I just think I just discovered a new talent in you, Frank. We need to.
And you too. So.
Yeah, now all of a sudden I know who to talk to when we have a movie.
Well, it's not genius; it's being a scatterbrain. So.
All right, Frank. Have a great day.
You too.
All right.
Thanks so much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Bye bye, Frank Burke, our good friend up in Wisconsin, and always a lot of fun to talk to Frank because, I mean, he always surprises me. He knows so much. Well, he should not that he surprises me, but, I mean, it's just overwhelming how well-read and how cultured and just what a great person and wonderful friend he's become. Well, that's going to do it for today, folks. Thank you so much. I got to go to a baseball game tonight, so I hope the Rangers win. I hope it's not too hot, but I know I'm going to eat a lot at the game, so I'm going to enjoy myself a great deal. We're going to leave you today with the music of our good friend Carlos Guedes. He's a local musician here in Dallas, and we've been featuring his music. He's got a brand new CD. It's absolutely great stuff. He's from Venezuela, and he's just a great guy. He's just a great musician, and he's a great songwriter, and this is all his original work. So check out his CD, Guedes, G-U-E-D-E-S. Have a great day, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.